Pharaoh's Dream. Well then, Pharaoh had betaken himself once more to instructive On, out of unconquerable yearning to escape from the empire of Amun, and commune with the shiny pates of the sun house about Harmachis Kepere Atum Re, Aton. The court chroniclers, puckering their lips and obsequiously crouching, mincingly entered in the record His Majesty's beautiful resolve, and how thereupon he mounted a great car made of electrum, together with Nefertiti, called Nefernefru Aton, the queen of the lands, whose body was fruitful and whose arm was about her consort, and how he had radiantly taken his beautiful way, followed in other cars by Ti, the mother of God, Nezemut, the queen's sister, Bakhetaton, his own sister, and many chamberlains and ladies-in-waiting with ostrich-feather fans on their backs. The heavenly bark, star of the two lands, had also been used by stretchers. The chroniclers had set down how Pharaoh, sitting under his canopy, had eaten a roast pigeon, also held the bone out to the queen, and she ate from it, and how he put into her mouth sweetmeats dipped in wine. At On, Amenhotep entered his palace in the temple district and slept there dreamlessly the first night, exhausted from the journey. The following day he began by sacrificing to Re Horakhte with bread and beer, wine, birds, and incense. After that he listened to the vizier of the north, who spoke before him at length, and then, regardless of the headache that had brought on, devoted the rest of the day to the much-desired talks with the priests of the god. These conferences, which at the moment greatly occupied Amenhotep's mind, had been taken up with the subject of the bird Bennu, also called Offspring of Fire, because it was said that he was motherless, and moreover, actually his own father, since dying and beginning were the same for him. For he burned himself up in his nest made of myrrh, and came forth from the ashes again as young Bennu. This happened, some authorities said, every 500 years. Happened, in fact, in the Temple of the Sun at On, whither the bird, a heron-like eagle, purple and gold, came for the purpose from Arabia, or even India. Other authorities asserted that it brought with it an egg made of myrrh, as big as it could carry, wherein it had put its deceased father, that is to say, actually itself, and laid it down on the sun altar. These two assertions might subsist side by side. After all, there subsists so much side by side. Differing things may both be true, and only different expressions of the same truth. But what Pharaoh first wanted to know, what he wanted to discuss, was how much time had passed out of the 500 years which lay between the bird and the egg, how far they were on the one hand from the last appearance, and on the other, from the next one. In short, at what point of the phoenix year they stood. The majority opinion of the priests was that it must be somewhere about the middle of the period. They reasoned that if it was still near its beginning, then some memory of the last appearance of Bennu must still exist, and that was not the case. But suppose they were near the end of one period and the beginning of the next. Then they must reckon on the impending or immediate return of the time bird. But none of them counted on having the experience in his lifetime, so the only remaining possibility was that they were about the middle of the period. Some of the shiny pates went so far as to suspect that they would always remain in the middle, the mystery of the Bennu bird being precisely this, that the distance between the last appearance of the phoenix and his next one was always the same, always a middle point. But the mystery was not in itself the important thing to Pharaoh. The burning question to be discussed, which was the object of his visit, and which then he did discuss for a whole half-day with the shiny pates, was the doctrine that the firebird's myrrh egg, in which he had shut up the body of his father, did not thereby become heavier. For he had made it anyhow as large and heavy as he could possibly carry, and if he was still able to carry it after he had put his father's body in it, then it must follow that the egg had not thereby increased in weight. That was an exciting and enchanting fact of worldwide importance. In young Pharaoh's eyes, it was worthy of the most circumstantial exposition. If one added to a body another body, and it did not become heavier thereby, that must mean there were immaterial bodies, or, differently and better put, incorporeal realities, immaterial as sunlight. Or, again differently and still better put, there was the spiritual. And this spiritual was ethereally embodied in the Bennu father, whom the myrrh-egg received, while altering its character thereby in the most exciting and significant way. For the egg was altogether a definitely female kind of thing. Only the female among birds laid eggs, and nothing could be more mother-female than the great egg out of which once the world came forth. But Bennu, the sun-bird, motherless, and his own father, made his own egg himself, an egg against the natural order, a masculine egg, a father egg, and laid it, as a manifestation of fatherhood, spirit, and light, upon the alabaster table of the sun divinity. Pharaoh could not talk enough with the sun calendar men of the Temple of Re about this event and its significance for the developing nature of Atom. He discussed deep into the night. He discussed to excess. He wallowed in golden immateriality and father spirit. And when the priests were worn out and their shiny pates nodded, he was still not tired and could not summon resolution to dismiss them, almost as though he were afraid to stay alone. But at last he did dismiss them, nodding and stumbling to their rest, and himself sought his bedchamber. His dressing and undressing slave was an elderly man, assigned to him as a boy, who called him Mani, although not otherwise informal or lacking in respect. He had been awaiting his master for hours by the light of the hanging lamp, and now quickly and gently made him ready for the night. Then he flung himself on his face and withdrew to sleep on the threshold. Pharaoh, for his part, nestled into the cushions of his exquisitely ornate bed, which stood on a dais in the middle of the room, its headboard decorated with the finest ivory work displaying figures of jackals, goats, and Bess. He fell almost at once into an exhausted sleep, but only for a short time. After a few hours of profound oblivion, he began to dream. Such complicated, impressive, absurd, and vivid dreaming as he had not done since he was a child with tonsillitis. In his dream, he stood on the bank of Hapi, the nourisher, in a lonely, marshy, uncultivated spot. He had on the red crown of Lower Egypt. The beard was on his chin, and the jackal's tail fastened to his upper garment behind. Quite alone he stood, heavy-hearted, and held his crooked staff in his hand. Then there was a rippling noise not far from the shore, and seven shapes mounted from the stream. Seven cows came on shore. They had probably been lying in the water like buffalo cows. They moved in a straight line, one behind another, seven without the bull, for no bull was there, only the seven cows. Magnificent cows they were, white ones, black ones with lighter backs, gray with lighter belly, and two dappled. Fine, smooth, fat kine, with bursting udders, long-lashed Hathor eyes, and high, curving, lyre-shaped horns. They began to graze contentedly among the reeds. The king had never seen such fine cattle, not in the whole country. Their sleek, well-fed bodies were something to see, and Mani's heart would have rejoiced at the sight if it had not felt so heavy and full of care. Feelings which presently gave way, indeed, to actual horror and fear. For these seven were not all. Still more cows came out of the water, joining those to these. Seven more cows climbed upon the bank, again without the bull, for what bull could have cared to join with such as these? Pharaoh shuddered at the kine. They were the ugliest, leanest, most starveling cows he had ever seen in his life. Their bones stood out on their wrinkled hides. Their udders were like empty bags with string-like teats. They were an alarming and upsetting sight. The wretched creatures seemed scarcely able to keep their legs. And yet, their behavior was so bold, so aggressive and sudden, one could never have expected the like from such decrepit beasts. Yet truly, it was all too natural, since it was the recklessness of starvation. Pharaoh watches. The haggard herd advances on the bonny one. The calamitous cows leap on the well-favored ones as cows do when they play the bull. The poverty-stricken devour and swallow the well-fed and simply wipe them off the earth. Afterwards, they stand there on the spot, as lean as ever before, without one single sign of being any fuller. Here this dream ended, and Pharaoh started from his sleep in a perspiration of fear, sat up with throbbing heart, and looked about in the mildly lighted chamber. It had been only a dream, yet so immediate, so speaking, that its urgency was like that of the starving kine, and lay cold in the limbs of the dreamer. He had no wish for his bed again, stood up, drew on his white woolen robe, and moved about in the room, musing on the dream and the pressing nature of that obviously absurd yet so vivid nonsense. Gladly would he have waked the slave to tell it to him, or rather to try if what he had seen could be reproduced in words. But he was too kindly to disturb the old man, who had had to wait up so long the night before. He sat down in the cow-footed armchair beside the bed, drew closer about him the moonbeam softness of his white wool robe, and dozed off again, his feet on the footstool, squeezed into the corner of the chair. But scarce was he asleep when he dreamed again. Again, or still, he stood on the bank in beard and crown and tail, and now there was on it a ploughed strip of black earth, and he beholds the loam disturbed. The crust rises, curls over, a stalk pricks forth, and one, two, even up to seven ears spring swiftly from it, one after another, all on one stalk, full fat ears bursting with golden fullness. How blithe the heart could feel at such a sight, yet cannot, for lo, the stalk keeps on shooting forth ears, seven ears more, poor, pathetic, dead and dry, scorched by the east wind, blackened with mildew and blight, and as they push out raggedly below the full ones, the fine large ears vanish as though into the poor lean ones. Truly it was like that. The wretched ears swallowed up the fat, just as before the ill-favored cows had devoured the sleek ones, and grew neither fuller nor better favored than before. This Pharaoh saw with his bodily eyes, started up in his chair, and once more found it all a dream. A confused, ridiculous enough dream, wordless and senseless, still it came so close, it so urgently assailed his mind with its burden of warning, that Pharaoh could not sleep again. Nor did he even wish to, till happily the dawn soon broke, but went on shifting between bed and chair, musing on the dream, or the twin dreams grown on one stalk, and its clear and pressing demand for clarification. Already he was firmly resolved not to let such a dream pass over silently and keep it to himself. He would make an occasion of it. He would sound an alarm. In it he had warned the crown, the crozier, and the tail. Beyond a doubt these were king dreams of imperial import, vastly suggestive and significant. They must be made public, and everything possible done to get to the bottom of them and study them on the basis of their obviously alarming meaning. Mani was greatly wrought up over his dreams. He hated them more with every minute that passed. A king could not put up with such dreams, although, on the other hand, they could not come to anyone but a king. While he, Neferkeperu Re Wanre Amenhotep, sat on the throne, such things must not happen. No such abominable cows must eat up such fine fat ones, or such wretched blighted ears consume such swelling golden ones. Nothing must happen in the realm of events corresponding to this frightful picture language, for it would reflect upon him. His prestige would suffer. Ears and hearts would be closed to the annunciation of Aton, and Amun would gain thereby. Danger threatened the light from the black earth. Danger from the material side threatened the spiritual, ethereal. There was no doubt about that. His excitement was great. It took the form of anger, and the anger swelled up into a great resolve that the danger must be revealed and recognized for what it was in order to meet it. The first person to whom he told the dream, as much as it lent itself to telling, was the old man who now came to dress him, arrange his hair, and wind the headdress round it. He only shook his head in amaze, and then gave it as his view that the dream came from the good God going to bed so late after he had heated his brain with all that wool-gathering, as he popularly and simple-mindedly put it. Very likely he unconsciously thought of the dreams as a sort of punishment for having kept his old servant up so late. "Silly old goat!" Pharaoh had said, half-laughing, half-angry. He gave him a light slap on the cheek and went to the queen. But she was feeling sick, being pregnant, and paid little heed. Then he sought out Ti, the mother goddess, and found her at her dressing-table in the hands of her maids-in-waiting. To her, too, he told the dream, finding it not at all easier to tell as time went on, but harder instead. Nor did he get from his mother much consolation or encouragement. Ti was always rather mocking when he came to her with his kingly cares, and he was so convinced that this was a heavy care that he began by saying so. And at once the bantering smile appeared on the maternal face. King Nebmare's widow had, after mature reflection, of her own free will, laid down the regency and given over to her son the ruling power of his majority. But she could never quite conceal her jealousy, and the painful thing for Mani was that he saw it all. This bitter reaction which he himself evoked did not escape him, while he sought to soften it by childlike pleas for counsel and help. "Why does your majesty come to me, the rejected?" she would say. "You are Pharaoh, so be Pharaoh and stand on your own feet instead of on mine. Confide in your servants, the viziers of the south and the north, when you do not know what to do, and let them tell you what is your will, if you do not know it. But not in me, for I am old and have retired." She behaved like that about the dream, too. "I am too much out of the habit of power and responsibility, my friend," she had told him with a smile, "to be able to judge whether you are right in giving so much weight to this matter. Hidden is the darkness, so it is written, when ample is the light. Let your mother hide herself. Let me even hide my opinion whether these dreams are worthwhile or befitting your state. They ate them up. They devoured them. Some cows ate up some other cows. Some withered ears, some full ones. That is no dream vision. You cannot see it or form a picture of it, either awake or, I should say, asleep either. Probably your majesty dreamed something quite different, and you have put in its place this monstrous picture of impossible greediness.